All of us are living through times of change that old ideas were not designed to accommodate. You know, social media and technology really have changed our world for better or for worse. And with the pandemic especially, these things have been brought to the forefront once again.
Welcome to Think About Policy, a podcast series brought to you by the Global Alliance for Behavioral Health and Social Justice. I'm your host, Geeta Jaffe, Senior Policy and Global Affairs Advisor for the Global Alliance. We are an interdisciplinary organization dedicated to informing policy, practice, and research for almost 100 years. Today's episode is the first of a three-part series on youth mental health and the roles of advocacy, social media, and communication. Before we get started, we have a content warning for the series, which includes discussions about depression, suicide, and suicidal ideation. And now, it is my great pleasure to introduce my co-host for this series of episodes, Dr. Amelia Burke-Garcia, a seasoned health communications professional with nearly 20 years of experience in program planning, implementation, and evaluation. Currently at NORC at the University of Chicago, she leads the organization's digital strategy and outreach program area, where she designs and implements strategies that leverage the power of digital media to influence behavior, most recently as the director for the award-winning How Right Now, Que Hacer Ahora campaign. She is the author of the book, Influencing Health, A Comprehensive Guide to Working with Social Media Influencers, and her new book, Communicating Through a Pandemic, A Chronicle of Experiences, Lessons Learned, and a Vision for the Future, is slated to be released this year. She has been highlighted by the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, for her work in honor of Women's History Month and has been named to VeryWellHealth.com's list of 10 modern female innovators shaking up healthcare. Amelia, thank you so much for joining us for this special series.
Thanks so much, Geeta. It's a pleasure to be here.
Last year, UNICEF issued a dire warning in the State of the World's Children report, which for the first time focused solely on the mental health of young people. The World Health Organization has also reported recently that suicide is the leading cause of death among young people in low and middle income countries, and the second leading cause in high income countries. In the United States, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, American Academy of Pediatrics, and the Children's Hospital Association declared child and adolescent mental health a national emergency and established Sound the Alarm for Kids. The Global Alliance is dedicated to listening, learning, and asking critical questions in the three-part series. We know youth today are struggling more than ever before. So what do we need to know? What can we do? How can we manage the negative aspects and promote the opportunities social media and communications hold? Well, let's get started in trying to answer some of the key questions. Our first episode is focused on exploring one person's experience with regard to mental health.
Joining us now is Diana Chow. Diana is a first-generation Chinese-American immigrant who founded Letters to Strangers when she was a sophomore in high school after bipolar disorder nearly ended her life. Today, Letters to Strangers is the largest global youth-for-youth mental health nonprofit and impacts over 35,000 people every year across six continents. Thank you so much for being here today, Diana.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my honor and pleasure.
So, Diana, I'm really excited to hear about your experience and the work you're doing, but I want to start out with just getting to know you a little bit better. So I'm wondering if you can tell me and our listeners a little bit more about yourself.
For sure. It's always a bit of an interesting question to answer. But just in terms of what I think might be relevant for this particular episode and, you know, for the listener, like you mentioned, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder when I was 13. And as a first generation immigrant who was growing up beneath the poverty line with parents who didn't speak English, you can imagine it was quite difficult for me to even began to understand how to seek access to care. And so that was when I started writing letters to strangers and discovered the power of my own voice and realized the motto that I adopt today, that writing is humanity distilled into ink. So that has been my driving force for the past few years. I graduated from Princeton last year, 2021, and it's been quite a journey for the past almost 8-9 years now with Letters to Strangers and looking at the intersection of race, ethnicity, even things like climate change. My major was geosciences, and I currently work my other job as a climate scientist on modeling extreme hazards, extreme weather events. So just looking at all these different intersections has really made me see firsthand how inevitable these discussions are and how important it is that we tackle them head on.
Wow. I mean, you're really touching on so many of the biggest issues that we're really grappling with as a society today: mental health, racism, poverty, and climate change. I mean, it's just impressive what you're doing at such a young age. So I want to get your perspective as a young person yourself. How do you think youth are doing today?
Certainly, I can't speak for every single youth out there, but I think the statistics are not lying. You know, we've seen suicide rates increase by 40% over the past few years, some places even 60% plus, depending on the age demographic you're looking at. And it's not something that I would say is surprising when we look at all the different factors that are affecting young people today. And all of us are living through times of change that old ideas were not designed to accommodate. You know, social media and technology really have changed our world for better or for worse. And with the pandemic especially, these things have been brought to the forefront once again. So as much as young people are becoming more aware of mental health as something that we all deal with, it's not happening in a vacuum, right? It's happening because there are more concerns arising out of people's minds.
Right. So with more awareness, we're also seeing more stressors. And so those two things there are positive and negatives happening at the same time. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Do you think there are particular issues that youth are most concerned with today, or things that are kind of causing the greatest stress for youth today?
Definitely information overload is one of them. And I don't just mean that in terms of seeing news all the time. That can be very traumatic, because that's definitely one thing. But the other thing is, you can imagine that when you're online and seeing all these different things that can affect you, whether that be comparisons to other people's body image, or comparisons to other people's statuses, or even this sort of, I don't want to call it a competition, but this feeling of like a competition that extends from the classroom out onto your daily life, wherein before you might be telling each other like, oh, I only got to sleep this much this previous day because I was so busy. And then someone else would be like, oh, well, I only got to sleep this much. And it's a little bit toxic in that sense. But now it's really across every facet of life. And so it's very hard to shut off that part of your brain and to have a little bit of moment to grow yourself, security, self-esteem and all of that away from these triggers and factors.
And so what role do you think social media plays in all of this, for better or for worse?
I'm sure plenty of people have touched upon the idea that social media is leading to more comparisons, especially unrealistic ones, with how easy it is to edit things, even in live video. The filters and everything oftentimes also reflect Eurocentric or other beauty standards that can particularly harm people who are marginalized. But another point I want to point out that I don't think is mentioned enough, and is particularly affecting younger folks, is this concept of mental health almost becoming a trend of sorts. I remember very clearly, I was talking to a high schooler about last year, and she was telling me how I must feel so lucky to have bipolar disorder, because everyone at her school has depression and anxiety now. It's not cool anymore. And I just was so shell-shocked that someone can think this illness that almost took my life is considered cool. And I think part of it is, you know, we're at a point where we're starting to talk about mental health more, especially among the younger generation, and that's fantastic. But the issue with having these discussions and these hashtags being trending is that seeing it more makes us feel like we know it better, but those hashtags and such are not followed up with education. And so it builds this false sense of security where we feel like we know what we're talking about, but actually what's being echoed more and more are still misconceptions and stereotypes from the past. And so what I think is a big issue is to recognize that mental health needs to be dived into with education with intersectional nuances in mind, going beyond perhaps more surface level consumerism based types of self-care, and recognizing that, you know, we don't have to get to a point where we feel like we have a diagnosis attached to our name in order to feel deserving of asking for support. To normalize talking about emotions preventatively before any diagnoses are attached to our names, and have that conversation in a safe space without feeling like we have to go to the extra step to be justified in having that conversation in the first place.
Yeah, wow. You mentioned so many really interesting points in that response. The idea of consumerism-based types of self-care and sort of superficial levels of discussion. I also really liked what you said about that while we have increased awareness and discussion, you know, it sometimes that can also like contribute to the information overload, and people may start to ignore it, right? So there's maybe more discussion, but how deep that discussion goes, you know, is something else that is potentially worth thinking about and doing something about. You mentioned education, and you mentioned sort of going beyond kind of surface level supports for youth. Are there specific components or things that you would like to see prioritized in terms of fostering youth well-being?
For sure. I think one thing is to really give people more ideas for healing, coping, protective strategies that don't necessarily focus on those more popular things like taking a bubble bath or whatever else. Recognizing these key concepts of, one, that when we're trying to support someone, our job is not to be the knight in shining armor. And I think that's a key thing that's making a lot of these discussions difficult, is that people feel like going into these conversations, they have to solve the other person's problem and they don't know how to do it. But in reality, most of the time, people just want to be listened to and feel cared about. And so our job is more as supporters is to more be like a companion walking alongside them as they navigate the road to heal, rather than trying to tell them how to fix themselves. So I think that's one thing. And another sort of strategy that I would like to see people talk about more is focusing on the variety of therapy and other help methods that are out there. Because now as we talk about it, there's this, you know, we talk about therapy a lot in the mental health sort of more trending side, but therapy is not it's not interchangeable with a specific type of therapy. There's so many different types of therapies. And yet oftentimes the conversation treats therapy as CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy, the sort of talk therapy people think of. And while CBT is fantastic for so many people, it might not be the right fit for other types of people, especially because you can imagine if someone is coming from a more collective culture background where the fear of talking about mental health is not even just about self-stigma, but also afraid of bringing shame and dishonor upon the family and almost like bringing more gossip into what the family is facing. If you're in a talking situation where you feel like you have to then speak almost badly about your family members and such, it can be very difficult to reconcile those demands. And so other types of therapy might be more useful. But when we talk, but when we narrow our definitions for these things to what is just trending at the moment, we forget that there's all these other components that can foster mental well-being that are existing out there, but perhaps are just not the most popular thing at the moment.
Right. You know, in my own work, we're seeing a variety of coping strategies being used. And that may mean more engagement with in one's community. It may mean, being a part and sort of deepening your connections to spiritual or faith groups. And so I think coping and support come in a variety of forms. And so I like what you're saying. It sort of expand our definition of those what those coping strategies and therapies can be. So I'm wondering in terms of, as you know, again, we're for this conversation and this podcast series, we're focusing on the role of social and digital and youth and mental health. I'm curious your thoughts on how our communities can promote youth well-being in the particular context of social and digital.
For sure. I think, you know, it's hard to avoid those surface level discussions when you're limited to such a short amount of time on all these platforms. But I think instead of trying to smash all of that into one like 60-second video, if we can start by doing deeper dives on just one specific topic in each video, it's not going to be as easy to get trending, but it is going to be more informative and hopefully more sustainable. And you know, one thing we can do is also to recognize that when we talk about mental health, especially in digital world, there are things that we can do on our end without even like creating content specifically about that topic that can still help things. So what I mean is like, for example, for someone who might be having body image issues, making sure that you're unfollowing specific influencers who are getting you really down, or if you feel like you have to follow someone but you don't want to see their posts, there's always that ability to like turn off their displays in your feed, even though you're still following them. Utilizing tools like what Instagram has built in that allows you, that gives you a warning when you've reached a certain amount of time on the app in the day to let you know maybe it's time to log off. And also recognizing that you can turn off things like autoplay videos on Twitter so that you have more control over these things. So all of that are steps we can take in the digital world beyond just creating content that can help protect our mental health. And that also means that when we are creating content, things we can do to benefit mental health doesn't always have to be in what we say. So for example, if we're going to be using a filter, even if it's just a fun one, being transparent about it, trying to be more accessible in our descriptions by including more links and, you know, including descriptions for people who might be visually impaired. All of these things are small steps that are not very obvious, but can make a big difference over the long term.
Yeah. And I want to go back to, I mean, those are incredible ideas. And I think they get a little bit to your point earlier about education and the importance of sharing content that can be educational. And we all know that mental health is complex, right? You talked about the different dimensions of it and how people perceive it differently, and it can affect people in different ways. You've done a lot of work through your nonprofit and on these topics and in particular on education. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about that work. And I was curious about your Youth for Youth Mental Health Guidebook. And through that guidebook, you've developed a lot of different types of virtual content that helps explore mental health and its intersectionalities with other areas. And can you, so I was curious if you could discuss with us that process and the outcomes of the series, and sort of where you got your ideas from.
For sure. Yeah. So a bit of background on the guidebook first. So the world's first Youth for Youth Mental Health Guidebook was written entirely by 14 to 21 year olds with reviews and all that by medical and industry professionals. We have about 1,000 scientific citations, and it dives deep into not just the basics of mental health, like different types of therapies, how to navigate the healthcare system, etc., but also intersectional mental health. So how race, ethnicity, LGBTQ plus identity, socioeconomic status, etc., can all impact your mental well-being. And a big reason for developing this is because I was thinking about how when I was starting my mental health healing journey, as someone who was born in the poorest province of China, growing up in a rural village, I grew up with more traditional values in my family that are not very compatible with some of the more Western individualistic ideals that I was confronted with in the US. And as I was trying to find, like, let's say Asian American or whatever mental health resources, oftentimes they would just be like a one page on like a website, and it's very surface level and paints everyone the same. And it's just very difficult to dive into the diversity of in-groups, within groups. And so I really wanted to create a resource that was deep, into those specific groups and understanding the complexities. And so, you know, one of the big things I learned from that whole research experience was that there are so many different ways we manifest our mental illness, and a lot of those ways are not necessarily considered by a Western psychiatric standard. So take, for example, culture-bound syndromes, which are symptoms of mental illness that particularly affect one culture of people, in this case defined as a non-white quote-unquote minority culture. This is something that's in the DSM, the diagnostic manual used to diagnose mental illnesses, but it's relegated to just the appendix of that huge manual. And in the previous edition of the DSM, it wasn't mentioned at all. Now, whether or not these syndromes are a thing is a whole other topic, but I just wanted to point that out because it's one thing, because you can imagine that as more countries around the world are adopting Western psychiatry for the first time, if you're having trouble seeing the way that people manifest mental illness in the manual that's supposed to tell you how to diagnose them, you can't even begin that conversation. And so similarly, you see people exhibiting psychosomatic symptoms, right? Physical manifestations of psychological distress. And this being something that occurs particularly more within people from backgrounds that have heavier cultural stigma against mental illness. I myself in high school was blind 50% of high school due to a psychosomatic blindness illness that all the doctors, all the tests came back telling me my eyes were fine, but I literally could not see anything. And so recognizing just how complex these different factors of our backgrounds can interplay with our mental wellness beyond what is perhaps taken as default in a Western psychiatric setting has been a huge learning process for me, especially when you take into consideration just how much history there is and intergenerational trauma being passed down through behaviors and such with all these different groups. So that's a big thing for us. And I just want to point out also that it's not just like a virtual guide. The guidebook itself is for free to download in black and white on our website, but it also comes in a print edition. And last November, we launched a teacher's curriculum guide to supplement that so we can bring this to more classrooms.
Wow, that's fantastic. And we know that students and teachers have been really struggling. And so on a number of levels. And so that seems like such an important resource to make available to youth and to teachers who are supporting youth. Your response made me think of something that I've heard in a couple places, and that really that culture is context, right? That culture matters as we think about these issues. And it's not just about where you live or what your educational background is or whatnot. I mean, all of those things come into play, but really considering sort of the larger picture of what somebody's, you know, lived experiences have been is really important for a number of issues and topics, but in particular for mental health and for addressing mental health challenges. As you think about the work you've done and your, you know, sort of expansion to teachers, what comes next? What are your next priorities?
We've been thinking about a lot where we've done all this work. We would love to get it to more schools and more students. And so one of our biggest priorities now is to get this resource into the hands of teachers and students. But on top of that, you know, there's so many other intersectional things we would love to delve into. Like in the guidebook, it's like this 80,000 word book. So we didn't want to make it any bigger. But there's other things like other types of disabilities and their intersections with mental health, or the military or the prison system and their intersections with mental health. And we would love to dive more into these things as well with our research in the future. But I think the most important thing is, you know, people want to ask what's going to happen next, right? Like you might find that you are realizing you have something you want to heal, but you're not sure what to do. And we do give those strategies in the guidebook, but having those strategies, but then not having those resources being available in your community makes focusing on those strategies quite difficult. So we're trying to provide more of those services where it's lacking. So for example, our Liberia chapter created the first Pan-African mental health hotline, and it's toll-free across most countries in Africa. We're working on the last few that we haven't been able to get telecommunications with, but it's at 9898 and it's 24/7. And, you know, it's just, and we also have a mental health resource center there that's open 24/7. You know, just these things to get people a tangible way to follow up on next steps once they have an idea of what they want to do, but aren't sure where to get that help.
That's such a nice segue to my next question, which is just the global impact that your work has had, which is impressive because you're talking about addressing mental health challenges for different contexts, different cultures, but also in countries with different types of regulations and healthcare systems and access to healthcare. So I'd love just to sort of talk a little bit about Letters to Strangers and your work to lead that group, to found and lead that group. It really has had impact and fostered global action at the individual, community, and policy levels. And like I said, it's just such an impressive achievement because of many of the challenges and barriers that exist to sort of operating, not just cross-culturally and across borders, but really, you know, across continents. And so I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about the key components and messages that you think should inform policies for youth mental health and really sort of how to meaningfully include youth in the policy process.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, I really appreciate the mention of the global aspect because I remember there's this misconception, and I've had people come to me after I gave a speech to ask this very question, where they thought for a long time that mental illness is something that can really only affect rich countries. This idea that, everything else doesn't, like, you only have the energy to think about your mental health once everything else is fulfilled. But everything is interconnected. And in fact, now suicide is the second leading cause of death for young people worldwide, not just in the US. And so this is something that is affecting really everyone. Mental health belongs to all of us. And so when it comes to these key components to foster policy, you know, one thing is certainly to include the people on the ground, right, in those communities, instead of acting like we're there to solve their problems for them, to be alongside them, to empower them, to feel like they have the capability to be, you know, the saviors of their own lives rather than have to rely on someone else. But the other thing is, I would say transparency. You know, a lot of times people are afraid of seeking help, whether it's because, whether in like a school setting or in a community setting, because they don't know what's going to happen to them. I get a lot of students who tell me that they were afraid of, you know, maybe their school is going to force them on a permanent leave of absence, or even, you know, utilize the current laws that will allow them to be arrested and sent to a psychiatric hospital forcibly if they told a teacher about their mental health concerns. And sometimes that might be necessary, but oftentimes it's not. Oftentimes people just want to feel supported and heard of and heard. And so when they don't know what the school's policy is going to be, if they tell anyone what they're going through, then they often feel like, well, maybe I just shouldn't tell anyone. So having these transparent policies will help alleviate a lot of that fear and uncertainty and empower more people to think they can seek support. And in a community setting, that could also look like with a healthcare clinic, you know, understanding, for example, if that healthcare clinic is providing healthcare for free, or if there's gonna be, you know, add-on costs later on, people are often afraid, especially when they come from lower socioeconomic standings, that they might be able to seek healthcare now, but it's gonna be all this unforeseen costs later on and they can't deal with that. So, or maybe their details will be, you know, leaked to other neighbors and then people are gonna laugh at them, and there's a lot of fear. So that transparency is so important. And last but not least, when it comes to involving people in the community, especially young folks in that discussion, I would also ask people to involve people who are working in this field, because oftentimes I remember when I was in high school, I lost a dear friend to suicide. And at the time I didn't know much about postvention, this idea of what to do after a suicide occurs. And I and a lot of other people were so upset for good reasons, obviously, but, you know, we wanted to have like this big mural, this big display of love for this person who passed. But after I learned more about postvention and copycat suicides and how grandiose gestures to almost make a person into a martyr after their death, how that can inspire people on the edge in the worst possible ways, I realized that there are safer ways we can go remembering a person. And so not all people, young people in the throes of passion might recognize these safety concerns, nor should they be expected to. So as we involve them, make sure to involve those working in the field as well, not just administrators, but people who are talking with these folks in the mental health space on a daily basis.
Your passion for this and your power for this topic are just completely shine through, Diana. And I just appreciate your honesty and your transparency in talking about these issues. I'm actually wondering, in case our listeners don't know, can you define postvention?
For sure. So postvention is a series of steps that, let's say, a school or a community can take in the aftermath of a suicide, wherein now there has been one suicide that has occurred, but we want to prevent future suicides from happening. And copycat suicides are especially likely to happen within a school campus because a lot of the people are very close to each other and they face similar concerns. And so suicide clusters particularly target young people. That's where having strategic steps for postvention to recognize how we can remember the person who passed, but also minimize gestures that can turn their story into a wrongfully inspirational one, where those steps can be taken to help the folks who are left behind feel like they can step forward without going down perhaps a path we don't want them to go down on.
So I just want to say thank you, Diana, both for your sharing your story, for sharing your expertise, for your work on letters to strangers. You are really, taking your life experiences and having impacts that are impressive and I think really important and critical at this moment in time. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for sharing all of this with me and with our listeners. This has been such a great conversation. I just really appreciate you being here with me today.
Thank you for having me. And if anyone wants to learn more about our work or get involved, we would love to have you. It's at www.letterstostrangers.org or on social media at L2S Mental Health. 2 is the number 2, not the word 2.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Diana. Back to you, Gita.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Thinking About Policy. As we heard, an engaging discussion about mental health for youth today and key considerations for action. From understanding intersectional mental health and the cultural implications of mental health resources and services, to the incredible movement behind Letters to Strangers and the Youth for Youth Mental Health Guidebook. We really appreciated our conversation today with Diana Chow, co-hosted by Amelia Burke Garcia, and you can find all of the links in the notes section. Please join us for episode 2 of our series on youth mental health and the role of advocacy, social media, and communication, which will be focused on practical steps for improving youth mental health. As always, you can find the Global Alliance on the web at bhjustice.org, on social media at All for BH Justice, and in Baltimore in October when we are #TogetherForAction2022. And join us in thinking about policy.